You're listening to SBS News.
Queensland now remains the only Australian state or territory without a redress scheme for survivors of the Stolen Generations, after Western Australia announced one this week. Survivors will be eligible for individual payments of $85,000, with the scheme to be open by the end of the year. Under government policies, more than half of all Aboriginal people in Western Australia were taken from their families or are related to survivors. The Healing Foundation has been advocating on behalf of Stolen Generation survivors. In this episode of Weekend 101, I spoke with the group's CEO, Shannon Dodson, who says it means a lot to survivors to receive this acknowledgement, and it advances the healing process.
A real mixture of emotions. I myself have family in WA who have been impacted by a removal, and I think that it's long overdue, but I think the fact that it's been put into action and hopefully will be dealt with in a way that is survivor-centred but also ensures that survivors can get payments quickly, I think it's really good news, and I'm really looking forward to working with the WA government on how we can deliver an effective scheme.
This comes on Reconciliation Week, which marks a couple of big milestones. What do you think is the significance of the timing of this? I know from the Healing Foundation's perspective, a lot of the Stolen Generation survivors are ageing. Many of them have passed. But your reflections on the timing of this?
I think obviously with National Sorry Day, to honour survivors and the experiences that they've been through, and it is that tabling of the Bring Them Home report 28 years later. So as redress is a recommendation from that report, I think that this is a very timely announcement, and I think that it's going to be something that's really important for survivors in WA. And I know that, you know, sadly we've lost survivors already, but I really hope that we can see this be put into action effectively. And with the
just listening to the speech by Roger Cook, he basically said $85,000 per person isn't really going to right the wrongs of the past, but provides a pathway forwards to the future. What are your reflections there on that sentiment there, that no amount of money could really right the wrongs of the past?
Look, it's true. No amount of money will ever compensate survivors for what they've been through. But what we have heard from survivors is that redress is a way of validating their experience. It's not just about the money. It's also that acknowledgement that these past policies have been destructive and that it has caused pain and trauma for people. So I think that that's why a scheme really needs to be not just about the money, but also about what are the supports that are in place for survivors to be able to tell their story, to have their experience validated. Also, what does that healing look like for them and their families? Because a scheme can't just be the life of the scheme. It's also what happens afterwards and what support can be provided to them and their families. So I think that we look forward to working with the West Australian government around some of the details and what is best practice for redress schemes, because as you mentioned before, WA and Queensland were the only remaining states that haven't had a redress scheme. So there's a lot of historical information and research that shows what an effective scheme can actually look like. So I think that we're really looking forward to working with the WA government to ensure that those best practice principles are put into place.
You said you've been speaking to some of the survivors about the news. What have been some of those very real reactions that you've seen them express after many years of advocacy?
The survivors I've spoken to have said that, you know, they've had many tears. I think it's a mixture of emotions, because many of them know that they have sometimes brothers and sisters or people that they know that have sadly already passed and haven't been able to see this come to fruition. So I think it is a mixture of emotions, but I think so many survivors are just so happy that this form of acknowledgement and validation has finally happened. And I think it's a bit of a better late than never. But I think there's still more work to be done. But largely, I think survivors are feeling that acknowledgement today.
You said one important element of how this was rolled out and implemented is it's not just about the money. Roger Cook also mentioned that the need for or the aim to have it be culturally appropriate. What are some of the things that your Healing Foundation's done a lot of work in this area, looking at a lot of redress schemes that would make it more effective in terms of the rollout and being culturally appropriate, particularly around, I guess, aged care and how that's tailored to not, I think in the past mistakes have been made where it's further re-traumatised survivors. Any insights and reflections on that point?
Look, I think there's a lot of great work that can lean into helping out with the details, but some of the things are it really has to be survivor-centred in terms of the concept, the planning, the implementation. That consultation with survivors is vital. And I think the other thing is that when we're talking about culturally safe or trauma-informed, it's really thinking about what funding and resourcing is put into stolen generation organisations and services and social and emotional wellbeing support for survivors, because this can be such a challenging process for many. And I think that we need to make sure that wraparound support is adequately resourced. And I think the other thing is also the flexibility. There needs to be flexibility when it comes to a scheme, because those eligibility requirements cannot be rigid. We've seen that with other schemes that it's really got to be down to a case-by-case basis often. And I think that if we can understand that those policies and sentiments didn't just stop the day that the policy ended, they continued for long after that, we need to make sure that we're taking that into consideration when thinking about eligibility and timeframes.
I've been reading that up to maybe 50% or more of WA's population of First Nations communities have been affected by this. Can you give us a sense on what this has meant? Because I think some people think, oh, that happened in the past, so what's the big deal? But it's still a very much present issue affecting First Nations communities. Can you give us a sense of that, particularly in WA?
WA does have one of the largest survivor populations and largest descendant populations as well. And the impact is still felt today because survivors are still here. You know, there are survivors that are not even 50 yet. And these are things that occurred in our very real recent history. And I think that we need to remember that many of these people were removed from their families. They were often told that their families didn't want them, or that sometimes their families had died. And that has such an immense impact on not only that individual, but then their children and their grandchildren. Survivors talk about how they didn't receive love and affection when they were growing up, which means they find it quite difficult to express that to their own children. This is the very real impact that it has for people. And I think it's just understanding that it's not something that, you know, people just get over. It's something that really is affects, as the Bring Them Home report found, almost every Aboriginal family has been impacted by forced removal. So to try and actually just understand the gravity of what impact that has, I think, is hard to fathom, but that's why it is just really important that we understand that compensation or redress is one part of the puzzle, but there's still work to be done in terms of what that intergenerational healing can look like for the next generations.
The timeline, I guess we have spoken about the very real fact that many survivors have passed in this years of advocacy. But a sense that Roger Cook has flagged by the end of this year, we can start eligibility starting from today, but payments could roll out by the end of the year. The need for urgency around the timeline on this, what are your thoughts there?
I think it's true there is an urgency, particularly for those older survivors that are unwell. And that is something we've seen in other schemes where they do fast track payments, particularly for those that are unwell or that are coming towards the end of their life. So I do think that's important, but I think that we also have to be cautious in the haste of pushing it out that we do it right. And so I think you balance that in terms of the urgency and the need, but also making sure that survivors are part of that process. But it is something that needs to happen. You know, we can't spend years perfecting the scheme. I welcome the idea that it will be opened, you know, potentially in the coming months, and the eligibility will start now. And I think that hopefully there will be sort of dedicated teams within the WA government looking at this and putting a really collective focus around how we roll it out successfully.
And the Healing Foundation did a report earlier this year that looked at, well, just how many recommendations have been clearly implemented since the Bringing Them Home report in 1997. And we're about 2 or 3 years away from a major milestone of the Bringing Them Home report. And only 6% of those recommendations were clearly implemented. What are your thoughts about more nationally what needs to follow from what we've seen from WA? Queensland is the outstanding state, but in terms of a national response, what do you think this should prompt in terms of more widespread strategy beyond just WA?
And I think it's really welcome seeing WA take this step, and I hope that it starts to get the other states and territories to think about how we do come together in collective action, because that is what our report showed, is that there just has not been a whole of government or systematic approach to the Bring Them Home recommendations. And what we're really interested in working with, not only the federal government, but states and territories, all parties, is that we can come together, whether it's a national healing package, which we've talked to, or some kind of plan about how we can ensure that survivors see the justice that they deserve. And, you know, we do have many survivors that are now eligible for aged care, ensuring that that is a supportive environment for them, as well as the issue of access to records. Many survivors still have not received prioritised access to their records. That issue of equitable redress, we hope that Queensland potentially follows suit after this announcement today. And I think also the other thing is really those services and stolen generation organisations needing sustainable resourcing to be able to support survivors, not only survivors now and into the future, but also their children and grandchildren.
This work is hard going. What keeps you pushing forward on this body of work?
I think it is hard going, but I also think, you know, I feel like it is my responsibility and accountability. My dad, you know, he headed up the National Inquiry, and he was the head of the Bring Them Home report. And I do feel like it is my responsibility to continue that work, because if we don't have these next generations taking up that fight and continuing the work, we're not going to see action. So I think that it just reminds me that, you know, survivors have gone through terrible pain, and I've had family members who have gone through that pain. And I think that really, us as that next generation, we need to ensure that we, you know, that we continue the work that they have been fighting for decades. So I think that's what really keeps me and so many others going.
A reflection with Reconciliation Week, which is a week long, about how Non-Indigenous Australians could approach this week. Any insights or ways that people who are still learning? I know there's this beautiful timeline on the Healing Foundation website that really encapsulates some key milestones on this journey, on how non-First Nations Australians can observe this week.
I think I would encourage people this week to look at the Healing Foundation website and really educate yourself about forced removal and stolen generations. And the more that you can have those conversations with your communities and your workplaces for them to understand just the intergenerational impact of this, I think is so important. But also I would encourage people to look at the stolen generation organizations in their own states and territories. There are organizations in pretty much every state and territory, and think about whether you can donate to them or offer your support or in-kind support in some way or another. As I said, many of those organizations are often volunteer-based or do not have the resourcing that they need to be able to provide the support. So I think there's probably just some ways that you can support this this week and in any other week, because, you know, these actions shouldn't be done just isolated to one week. And also I would encourage people to, you know, reach out to your local governments and to, you know, the federal government to sort of ask about the actions that are being taken for survivors and, you know, to really push for that further implementation of support that's needed.
Does the theme this year for Reconciliation Week have a particular resonance for you?
I think it's really important that young people particularly, I know that Stolen Generation survivors want to ensure that the memory of what they've been through and that impact is never forgotten, and that we continue to pass that on down to those generations. There's a lot of people that don't know about the Stolen Generations, and I think that many survivors have just really wanted to ensure that that continues to be passed down. So I think young people, you know, have a big opportunity to step up and to have these conversations. And we do have a schools kit on our website, which can help teachers and educators to be able to talk about these things with young people, and also to be able to talk about it in your workplaces and with your families. And I think that's just a really important element of continuing these conversations, so that survivors, you know, don't feel like their experiences are being ignored or invalidated.